You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, where we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a TV presenter and a writer specializing in food and science. Now, this podcast is the third in our series on digestive health and the gut microbiome. Now, anyone who knows me will be aware of my seminal work in this field as the author of a book called Fartology. But I'll admit that its remit is limited to just one aspect of gut health. So we've decided to draw on the advice of three brilliant healthcare professionals so we can explore the advances in gut health and the digestive system around now. So we have Julie Thompson, Information Manager from Guts UK.
Hello.
Alison Clark, Nutritionist and Gut Microbiome Researcher and Medical Writer.
Hello.
Mariette Abrahams, CEO of Kina.
Hello.
Okay, now, Julie, if you can just start us off, really, give us a bit of a grounding in the subject. What is the gut microbiome?
Okay, so this is a massively exciting area, and lots of people have become very, very interested in the gut microbiome. And there's been a sea change in scientists' understanding, really, of the interaction of our microbiome and the relationship with us. So I like to think of humans as an ecosystem, which is dynamic and complex. It's rather like a rainforest in its diversity, the microbiome, and in the same way that worms break down leaves and logs to turn them into compost, our gut bacteria break down the food that we eat to provide nutrients that we wouldn't normally have available to us. But that's not all these enigmatic creatures do. They also teach our immune system what is friend and foe. And this is really a two-way communication system, so our immune system will also direct which microbiome they want to have a relationship with. They provide fatty acids, which feed gut cells to keep them healthy. They also protect us from pathogenic or bad bacteria overwhelming the microbiome and causing digestive infection and illness. But what we're also learning is that the microbiome and the immune system interaction are also likely to be genetically driven. Plus, what we eat influences this relationship as well. So they are actually part of us, and we need to look after them properly.
Julie, that was absolely brilliant. You should be the information manager at a guts charity with that kind of tool at your disposal. Now, that was really, really good. Now, Alison, this is a hugely exciting area of science. Why? Why is it so exciting? What is unfolding at the moment that is evidence-based information that we can actually use?
Well, I would say that there's been in the past, decade, past 20 years even, there's been just a huge boom in gut microbiome studies. And that's because they affect all aspects of our health that we're discovering, beyond digestive health, as well as mental health, our skin, cardiovascular health, hormone detox like estrogen, even mitochondrial function, bone health, and immune health, as Julie mentioned. And so that's why it's so exciting. Unfortunately, we still have not identified a core healthy microbiome yet. We do have some ideas about which bacteria are, families and genera and genus of bacteria are more beneficial than others, but there's still kind of no kind of what we like to call core healthy gut microbiome. And so that just shows that these studies are still in their infancy. So every day.
And also that's why it's exciting, I guess.
Right.
Because there is still so much that's yet to unfold.
Exactly. And so with that in mind, it's just really exciting because I think a lot of health experts and doctors are really discovering that our health really starts in a lot of ways in our gut. And that's because, apart from what Julie already mentioned, that the gut microbiota is also responsible for the absorption and assimilation of nutrients, vitamin synthesis like folate, vitamin K2, and choline. They produce beneficial metabolites such as short-chain fatty acids, which do a myriad of wonderful functions, including they have anti-inflammatory properties. They can even alter our gene expression, which is really cool. And the gut microbiome affects our overall digestive well-being. And so I think it's just really important to focus on our gut health. And I think it's really empowering to know that with diet and lifestyle changes, we can modify our gut microbiomes. That just because we have a certain kind of gut microbiome profile now doesn't mean that that's our destiny. We can.
Okay. That's the dynamic bit, isn't it? Yeah. That's the bit that we can change. Okay. Which brings us beautifully on to Mariette. Now, Mariette, you work with companies, and especially in the sort of personalized nutrition area. So considering that we don't know everything yet about digestive health, there's a huge industry in any case developing around this. So what is it that we do know that can be used to create products that help us?
Yeah, that's great. So we see a lot of movement and interest in particular within the gut health area, especially with looking at millennials who have an interest in using kind of food as a way of improving their health and not necessarily, you know, just looking at disease. So they are really interested. And so we are seeing this exciting kind of development of fermented products. So we're looking at fermented drinks, for example. We are seeing a proliferation of fermented foods. And that is not only in terms of kind of products, but also in terms of ready-made meals. So there's one product that was just released that looks at macaroni for athletes that has added probiotics, for example. We also are seeing an interest in the development in terms of teas and coffees and oatmeal and granola and snacking products in particular. So all of these have not only probiotics added to them, they also are using prebiotics as well. And so there's some great examples of that on the market. And not only with that, the trend towards using clean labels, because we know that things like sweeteners and emulsifiers also have an impact on gut health, that we are seeing more and more products coming out that are focusing on a more clean label kind of product. In terms of specifically looking at personalized nutrition as well, what we are seeing is for those, it's still very niche, but that there's a combination of kind of using the testing of the microbiome in terms of a physical product. So whether you are buying a granola or muesli and seeing how that's impacting your gut microbiome on a continuous basis. So we are seeing it on a very small scale, but companies are starting to combine the diagnostic tools together with the physical products in the marketplace.
And can you just roll back one second, Mariette, and just explain to us, what does personalized nutrition mean? Because it's quite specific, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of confusion, which is hopefully we can get this message also across in the podcast, and that there is a lot of confusion about what the definition is about personalized nutrition, but there have now been two definitions kind of defined at the beginning of this year, which really looks at the ability to provide personalized nutritional recommendations that are grounded in science and that are measurable over time. And that is kind of the defined definition. But we need to remember that within personalized nutrition, it is not always about testing. About 65% of people have some kind of a dietary preference, you know, follow some kind of a dietary pattern. So whether it is that they not, you know, eliminating dairy or whatever the case might be, that is a form of personalization in any event. So I think the term is broader than people think, but it has been very much limited, especially in the way of communication, to it being, you know, constrained to a test.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, Julie, there are a lot of products out on the market. There's a lot of appetite from consumers for these products. And that, you know, that there are people buying things because they feel it's better for their health. As somebody sort of removed from making their profit, making their dosh from all this, what's your view on all these things? Is it too much profiteering, or is there some really good stuff out there that's brand new that really will change people's lives?
So I think with regards to specifically sort of microbiome testing, it's really only academic at the moment.
But you can send away your nice little sample and get it done.
I absolutely can. And
why do you say it's only academic then within
that? Right, because we don't really have the evidence that, you know, changing Getting your microbiome tested and then changing your diet and then getting it retested is actually evidence-based.
Yeah.
The reason for that really is that we just don't know. We can't sort of do a test and then suggest a treatment at the moment.
And that's due to the sheer complexity of the different microbes in the system and trying to work out, well we know you, so you can send away your stool sample and get a list of the different microbes back, but we don't really know what to do with that information. Is that right?
Scientifically, yes, we don't know. I mean, if you were to sort of have the test, and I'm not suggesting anybody does this, but takes it along to their GP, the GP would probably be extremely interested in the results. But they probably say, you know, we don't have enough evidence at the moment to be able to give you either a food or a diet that will actually definitely change that and lead to improvements. So whilst that may come in the future, I think we are too early in the stages for this at the moment.
Yeah. And what about all of the other products? Just literally the products that say good for gut health. Is this just a throwaway mantra, or is there a good reason to have that written on a label and a good reason to buy the foods?
So I think, I mean, it can come down to sort of labeling and regulation here as well. So for example, for probiotics, the European Food Standards Agency really haven't conferred the ability to label probiotics as good for gut health. But, you know, as a group, they may well have changes to the microbiome, but we don't necessarily know. For some people, they may change it. For others, they might not. So with respect to probiotics and, again, prebiotic supplements, they might not. I don't think we've got enough information about those at the moment either, really. But food and fibre is a different matter, and using those to produce products can actually sort of improve constipation, for example, if you're looking at increasing fiber in the diet. So it depends on what companies are doing to change products, yeah. I think.
But on a personal level, when you hear the latest sort of, they're not health claims, but the latest guy, you know, claim that's made that a product is good, do you roll your eyes and go, oh, for God's sake?
Again, it depends on what it is and what the message is. I think sometimes I would say definitely I do. For others, maybe not.
Yeah. Okay. Now let's move on to Alison. Why don't we know this information? I mean, can't you just feed somebody some stuff and then come up with a conclusion to it? Why is nutritional research so difficult and complex?
Well, part of the problem and the complexity of it all is you're dealing with your metabolism, your genetics, your genetic expression, which is something actually different, as well as your gut microbiome. And then to add on top of that complexity, you have your diet and lifestyle mixed in there. So there's several different factors here that are working together that can modify our health and our gut microbiome. So it's not a black and white situation. Now, if we move beyond that, we look at just the microbiome studies that we have right now. We have an issue with testing. You can use 16S rRNA sequencing. You can use shotgun sequencing. So depending on what kind of metagenomic analysis you're using, you're gonna get different results. It's quite expensive to do these metagenomic analysis. And then if you look at also a lot of studies are done in animals, which are not completely reflective of the human gut microbiome, although we can get a little bit of a sense. And then another issue that we have too is there's very few longitudinal studies, which are long-term studies. So when you look into, you know, the methods and materials of these studies and you're actually reading, you know, the fine print and the nitty-gritty details, you'll notice that a lot of times they're only taking one fecal sample or very few fecal samples over a short period of time, and they're not taking several samples over a long period of time. But what we do know about a lot of studies is that if you're following a long-term diet and your lifestyle hasn't changed very much, which means that you're basically sleeping more or less the same, you're living in the same house with the same people, your stress levels are more or less the same and your diet has stayed the same, then we can assume that your gut microbiome is probably not going to change so much unless you're taking new medicines or something like that. So it's just a lot of factors to take into consideration.
And so really much data, and it's overlapping.
And when we look at one microbiome sample, it's really just a snapshot. And when you think about how diet, just modifying your diet can change your gut microbiome in a matter of a few days, it gets even more complicated.
Yeah. Now, and a lot of this area seems to be driven by people's opinions and what people say on Instagram and things like that. Now, Mariette, when it comes to developing a new product, what is it that companies are looking for? Are they looking to respond to what people think online? Are they looking to pick up some research and build a product around that? What is it that they're after?
Yeah, I think the tide has changed quite a bit. And that is only because consumers are more educated and definitely more interested in health and wellness. So the tide has changed in that it's become more consumer-centric, I would say. So looking at doing consumer research and seeing what it is that they are specifically interested in first. Using that information to then seeing what is currently available within their portfolio, or then designing new studies and seeing what the impact is within those specific groups. But I think definitely where it was in the past more marketing driven, it's now mainly driven on what the consumer interest is, having a science-based approach and getting scientific backing, because consumers do want the evidence to back it up. Not only the evidence to back it up, but also understanding how the products are impacting them as an individual. And that is really how things are changing at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I mean, let's look at some real details now. Alison, what foods are there that you can take that we know will improve your gut bacteria and digestive health? I mean, does it work like that?
Well, I mean, I think I think we're inundated nowadays with so many, quote unquote health experts who are coming out with all these pushing all these fad diets, and we kind of get lost in the noise. And I think we kind of need to go back to basics here, that you want to be sticking to a whole foods diet. And the research has shown that a whole foods diet that's rich in fruits or vegetables, and that's high in fiber, is really going to be your best friends for your gut microbiome. And regardless of your protein intake, whether it's animal or plant-based, you always want to make sure that you're getting enough fiber intake. So fiber and prebiotics, which we talked about, and prebiotics come from like green bananas, garlic, asparagus, onions, whole grains, and chicory, for example. Fermented foods are really great if you can tolerate them. This, you need to kind of play around with it because it's very individual depending on your gut microbiome. But in general, I would say foods that are high in probiotics, such as yogurt, kefir, miso, and sauerkraut, are pretty well tolerated. Resistant starch, which you get from cooled and cooked potatoes, are really great. They help feed beneficial bacteria that produce really great metabolites that I mentioned earlier, short-chain fatty acids, which are really great for your health. They have so many benefits. And polyphenols, which you can get from the quote-unquote superfoods, like berries, pomegranates, cacao, olive oil, and green tea, and those feed beneficial bacteria.
And I mean, everything that you said there, I think all of us would agree that's absolutely spot on. But Julie, the issue about this message is that it's just not sexy for consumers. They want something that says I'm a magic pill to change things. A whole food diet people see as complicated and oh God, have I got to cook my own food and things. When these very, very clear nutritional concepts come up against the consumer, they want something different. What the heck's going on?
Well, I think sort of changing the diet and all those foods that Alison just mentioned are really sexy, in the diet.
Okay.
Fabulous. But yeah, I do appreciate that people want something new. And there's no reason why manufacturers can't sort of use variety and things like that in the products that they're developing, as a concept to
Let's throw that exactly that back to Mariette. So does the industry have a problem with using those kinds of claims? I mean, is it very difficult to put a claim on food just because it's got the right balance of fatty acids in? What holds people back?
No, I mean, I wouldn't say my area is not within in food claims. What I would say in terms of the availability of food, I think we need to have a very good understanding of how people choose food. So what is the behavior in terms of the food choices that people make, and how can we use that to then either fortify or make it easier? So making healthy eating, you know, the easier choice for people. And that's really the crux of where we need to get to. So if we know that the average intake is about 17 grams of fiber at the moment, and we need to get up to 30, the chances are that that's going to take a very long time unless there are better products out there that are made that contain higher amounts of fiber, but that or that have functional components, but are still affordable for the mainstream consumer. And that's really how we could improve, you know, some of these special foods or the fiber content that we need to improve.
Now, Julie, back. Let's have a think about now the supplements industry. Now, what's your view on the idea of supplementing your food and solving your dietary problems in that way?
So do you mean vitamin and mineral supplements here?
Yeah, and probiotics, you know, and yeah. You can buy different types of dietary fiber, you know, is this back to the idea of people want a magic bullet rather than a lifestyle change that will suit them?
I think that probably is, you know, some aspect of it, really. I mean, you know, the only area where, as dietitians, we would advise supplementation is during the winter months with vitamin D. You know, supplements, vitamins and minerals in particular, can affect digestive function. You know, for example, calcium as a supplement can cause constipation or diarrhea. So it's not always the best route to take unless you know that you've got low levels and your doctors advise you to take them. With prebiotics, so little tablet supplements and things like that with prebiotics, again, I don't think there's a huge amount of evidence in the general population that they are overall beneficial. And the difficulty, I think, with probiotics is that you know, from a manufacturer point of view, it's, you know, there's a wide range of these probiotic products. They're found in all sorts of different functional foods. So you can get yogurts, you can get drinks that have probiotics added to them. And every time you make a change to that, you're really changing that product. And I think that has affected the evidence base that we have for research. So for good evidence, what you need to have, so for example, if you were looking at a drug, you will look at maybe a drug and there will be maybe sort of 500 or 1,000 research papers that you can combine together, which will give a good evidence base. But because probiotics are so variable, we can't actually do that. And, you know, some of the areas where they've tested the same probiotic, there's been varying results. So I think it's difficult for
like as with so many areas it's complex and it's difficult, and I wonder if companies are making hay from that, really. So let's have a little think about the gut's role in immune response. Alison, is there any evidence that we can use to help our immunity and our immune response?
Yes, well, kind of a little unknown. Well, first of all, let me just say that approximately 70% of our immune system is actually in our gut. So I would say that just focusing on overall digestive health and you know, focus with a focus on your gut microbiome is key for overall immune health. So like going back to what I said, I know it's not quite as sexy, but sticking to a whole food diet, trying to stay away from, you know, some of the processed foods and the alcohol and the sugar. I know it's not as fun. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but it's just, another thing that's also, I think kind of an unsung hero in gut health is vitamin D. So here we all in, you know, this coronavirus pandemic, many of us are forced to be, you know, in quarantine or lockdown, shelter in place, whatever you want to call it. It's the middle of spring and we need sunshine exposure more than ever to increase our vitamin D levels. And vitamin D is not only important for your bone and immune health, but it also has been shown to support a healthy gut microbiome and the integrity of your intestinal lining. So I think, you know, between food and the vitamin D, and I also say that stress plays a huge role in immune health. So that we know that when you have high stress levels, you have high cortisol levels, which can negatively affect our immune system as well as our gut microbiome. And you also want to be going back to basics again, making sure you're getting enough sleep around 7 to 8 hours a day and moderate exercise throughout the week. And, oh, another thing too, sorry. I'm very passionate about this. You got to get dirty. Germs are our friends. So I think we're now, especially in this coronavirus pandemic that we're all in, we're in this kind of hyper hygienic state, which is all well and good. But in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking about the gut microbiome. And I'm always thinking about, well, all this hand sanitizer and staying inside, you know, for a very long time. And I'm living in Spain right now. We're not even allowed to go into wooded areas. And I keep thinking, how is this affecting our gut microbiomes long term? Because in order for our immune system to be primed and know what's friend or foe, what to attack and what's, you know, what's our friend and what's a pathogen, we have to be constantly exposed to microbes from animals, from dirt, from being around other people, from being in the woods, from going to the beach, you know, not washing your hands constantly. So I know this is kind of going against the status quo right now, but I have to say that we have to be getting dirty more and focusing on being in nature as well.
Alison, are you just trying to get excuses not to Hoover the house?
No. Well, I mean, I may or may not have gone into some wooded areas near my house, but don't tell the local authorities.
Okay. Now, Marriott, what about mental health issues? Again, are we in this area where we know that gut health can be influenced by, can influence our mental health, but we don't know what to do with that information? Or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, I think there was recently a very big study that looked at the impact of kind of diet on our mood, and specifically looking at our microbiome. And it seems that, you know, the best way to make sure that you impact your microbiome is by following a more Mediterranean style diet that is, as we discussed with all the other factors, first high in fibers, high in antioxidants, is lower in kind of animal proteins, low, you know, medium amount of dairy, and that has got the biggest impact in terms of, you know, your mental health. So there's a lot of information in terms of just following a healthier, high fiber diet to impact your mental health.
Yeah, but in terms of food manufacturers and food companies making products, are they trying to tackle mental health issues? Are they trying to claim that you can eat yourself happy with their products?
Not from what I've seen. What I've seen is that there is now an understanding that, you know, this area of research is really, really up and coming, and consumers are really, really interested in this area. So I think because they can't make claims, there are no claims that this ingredient or this product will immediately make you happy, for example, because the scientific evidence is just not there. However, from a consumer point of view, they would like to understand what can they do. And so for a manufacturer point of view, or for the food industry in general, there is really, really a good opportunity to kind of be transparent and signpost to credible sources, for example, or even using kind of healthcare professionals or influencers that are credible to kind of make sure that the state of the science is communicated accurately. But the basics will still stick in terms of, you know, the Mediterranean diet kind of components.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Julie, can we move to sort of looking at the future in terms of research? What is being worked on at the moment that you think is very exciting, that has potential to shift how we think about the gut microbiome?
Okay, so there are lots of interesting areas actually. So one of the areas is a study that was done at King's College that looked at the volatile organic compounds that are formed when the gut microbiota ferment fiber in irritable bowel syndrome. Mm-hmm. And in that particular example, the volatile organic compounds could actually identify which people would benefit from following a certain diet.
When we say volatile organic compounds, are we talking about the smell of your farts?
Yes, we're talking about...
Yes! Get in. Beautiful. So, okay, sorry. I'm distracting you from a very important point. Okay, so do carry on.
So actually, you know, that is one area that although it's still under a research phase, it does have evidence, and it may well be that that is developed into a test that's used to do before the people are advised to follow a diet or not.
Go on, give put a bit more meat onto the bones of this. Are we, mm-hmm. are we saying that you get a sample of gas and then you put it through a mass spectrometer or something to work out what's inside it? How does it work?
Yes, so that's very, very similar to how it works, actually. And we know by looking at the results of that and looking at sort of people following these diets, which people will respond to them and which people won't. So that actually probably... you know, one of the first areas that we could possibly have a treatment based specifically on testing of the microbiome in some way.
And IBS is an enormous problem, isn't it? That affects a huge amount of people.
Absolutely. 10% of the UK population. And, you know, it may well be that numbers of people with IBS are increasing as well. So another area, I came onto the podcast today, I was thinking about sort of what areas actually in digestive diseases were implicated in the microbiome. And I think it's probably with digestion better to look at what's not. So another example would be bowel cancer. So there have been some studies that have looked at sort of people with bowel cancer and taken microbiome samples from the area of where the cancer is, and the microbiome profile is different to the rest of the gut. Now, the problem is we don't know necessarily whether that's what's caused the cancer in the first place, or whether that's because of microbiome changes because of the disease. So we don't know enough about it yet, but these are the types of research that people are looking at.
Yeah. Okay. And Alison, any research that you think is particularly exciting that sheds light on new areas?
Yeah, I would say the expansion of the systems biology studies, so also called omic studies. So that includes microbiomics, which is a study of the microbiome, metabolomics, which is a study of metabolites that affect our metabolism, transcriptomics, and the study of the RNA transcripts in our cells that affect our gene expression, as well as proteomics, which is a study of proteins and all their myriad functions. And the whole goal of this is to understand sort of the gene nutrient interactions that goes on, so that we can get a more personalized approach to health and diet to optimize not only our own specific health needs, but also disease prevention.
So personalized nutrition aspects you think are very exciting as well.
Yes. I mean, we still have a lot of work to do in that area, just because, you know, the testing methodologies are varied. We need more long-term studies, especially in humans. Yeah. And there's just a lot of confounding factors that, you know, I think we've already mentioned that it's a lot to tease out and understand right now. But I think it has a lot of promise. And I think if we can kind of narrow it down more and really understand sort of those gene microbiome and nutrient interactions, we can go a long way in preventing, I think, a lot of diseases, especially not only metabolic diseases, but I also say immune-related diseases like autoimmune diseases as well, because certain foods can provoke immune responses that can trigger autoimmune-like symptoms.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Mariette, what new research is on your radar? What do you think is exciting out there?
Yeah, so same as Alison, I agree in terms of the omics. So we are looking at what research is coming out in terms of blood sugar, so diabetes or pre-diabetes, and how that relates to the gut microbiome profiles of people. Also looking at gender-specific personalized nutrition information. So we know already that women suffer more from digestive disorders, but then all the clinical, you know, studies that were done beforehand, prior to this whole omic era, is that women were very much underrepresented in a lot of these clinical studies. So much of what we know is based on how men responded to either, you know.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, now that we have, you know, better technology, better data capturing, and the ability to capture real world data with sensors and wearables, for example, we can put all of that together, and then using, you know, advanced analytics to come up with more of a personalized profile of people and seeing what would be, you know, suit them better. And that to me is incredibly exciting.
And I think the analytics and the quality of the data really is going to be key to understanding anything more about the gut microbiome, isn't it?
Correct.
Okay. But that's absolutely fantastic. I think we should just end with one last question to each of you, because we could just carry on for hours chatting about this. So what I'd like to ask you all is, could you tell us about your favorite gut health tool that you actually use yourself? Now, this could be an ingredient, a food, some exercise, or a book, or something less tangible as well. Maybe it's a thought process. But can you tell us what you do and what you use to improve your own gut health? Now, Julie, can we start with you?
Okay, so I generally tend to try and get as many different varieties of foods in my diet. So I'm talking about sort of the sexy fruit and vegetables here. and I also I do have oats in my diet for breakfast with yogurt. I also like to get out in nature and go walking and things like that as well.
So basically, your favorite gut health tool is a halo over your head.
For 80% of the time, maybe.
That's pretty good. Okay. And Alison, what's your favorite gut health tool or a food or an ingredient? Anything you like.
Yeah, I have to agree actually with what Julie said. Was I try to focus on eating, you know, a varied diet with different, you know, try to eat the rainbow, different colors and different types of fiber whenever I can, although I'm not perfect. I do try to get in nature every day when I'm not in the middle of a pandemic. And I mean, I'm a researcher, so I'm a big nerd. I read, you know, PubMed all the time. But for, you know, the listeners at home, I think there's some really great books out there just to get you to give a really easy understanding of the gut microbiome and its effect on our health. I can list a few.
Go on, give us one title.
Okay, Missing Microbes by Martin Glaser.
Fantastic. Okay, we'll have a look at that. Okay, and Mariette, what's your favorite gut health tool?
So I have three key tools. The first one also, I love my fiber. So I have a very high intake of vegetables, I would say. And I love cooking. So I always include different types of whole grains in my diet. The other second thing that I do is I do find that yoga is the miracle cure for my gut if I have any problems or cramps or anything. So I do find that yoga works really, really well. And then I do also believe that for me, a small bit of chocolate alpine in cocoa is excellent for my gut health.
I second that.
Yeah, hearing all these claims. Okay, that's absolutely fantastic. Well, thank you so much to all of you for joining us. I know that we'll be looking at this area again and again to see how it evolves. So I look forward to speaking to you again. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast from Food Matters with Julie Thompson, Alison Clark, Mariette Abrahams, and me, Stephen Gates. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to robotics. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.